Thank you, Nipun. And thank you, Nipun's parents, for hosting. And I've always wanted to come here and just haven't had the chance. So it's great to be with all of you. So I'll land on some science that I think will be really interesting to this community that Nipun has anticipated. But I wanted to give you a little bit of a personal journey about how I got there and then get to the science. And I'm also, you know, at an age in the middle of life where you think back to why are you sitting here in this chair next to Nipun and talking to you and thinking about the narrative that gets you to where you are at this moment. And I was really lucky to grow up with a couple of parents who were very experimental and very open to radical ideas and new ideas. My mom was a literature professor and a social activist, and I think if I were to say what she really got me interested in addition to things like yoga and massage and alternative foods in the late 60s when people just didn't do those kind of things, she was really interested in compassion, and to this day is interested in the sectors of our society that suffer. And the nature of human suffering, and volunteering in prisons, and you know, teaching people who don't have access to things like that. And she was a literature professor. And as Molly, my wife, who's back there, will tell you, my mom is sort of steeped in the humanities, where proof isn't as important as interesting discourse. And and I'll get to you why I became a scientist. And I think in many ways she was interested in consciousness, because she studied Virginia Woolf, who was one of the great Western experimenters of human consciousness in the written word. And then my dad was just as experimental, and he was an artist. And, you know, so as ever since I was a young kid, I would, you know, find sanctuary in museums and look at paintings. And I remember some of my most early compelling experiences were looking at paintings by the Dutch masters or Jan Steen, or just looking at how they portray human joy and just looking carefully at the aesthetic portrayal of emotion. But again, my dad was an artist. And so I grew up in this very unusual home, and I wish I'd given my kids a little bit more of this kind of open inquiry. But I grew up in a home that was full of these radical ideas, and I was a born scientist. You know, in first grade, I got second prize in the cake baking contest with my cake that was a Tyrannosaurus Rex, right? And, you know, all these young girls got first and third and fourth prizes, and I claimed second prize with a little cake of the Tyrannosaurus Rex, and I loved dinosaurs. And I, you know, pathologically used to keep track of scores of baseball. And for a year I played solitaire and wrote down every outcome of every hand that I got and had them in little booklets. And I used to do, my mom would float these ideas like, you know, pyramids have magical powers, and can recharge batteries. And you may remember this kind of thinking. So I tested those ideas as a little fifth grader, right? And I built pyramids and grew snapdragons in them and compared them to control conditions. And my mom's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm testing this, Mom, you know? And I just couldn't help myself. You know, I just, I gravitated to science and math and those kinds of things, even though I look like a surfer. And I'm a terrible surfer, but I was good at math. So... and that was really, that was the deep personal and intellectual background to where I ended up heading as a young scientist. And I think my, I want to talk about compassion and what we've learned, and gratitude and what we've learned scientifically, and then awe, and where we're going. But I want to tell you about the origins of those interests. One of them was, after graduate school at Stanford, I did a postdoc with a fellow named Paul Ekman. And Paul Ekman, whom many of you have heard about, was this pioneer in that in the mid-60s, he devoted 7 years of his career to figuring out how to code every visible facial muscle movement by changes in the appearance to the face. It took him 7 years. No one had even gotten close to this kind of systematic kind of characterization of what happens in the human face. And it was inspired by Charles Darwin, who wrote in 1872 The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals, where he had really described how our emotions are mammalian. They aren't just humans, they aren't just Victorian, they are mammalian. And Darwin drew upon his observations of his babies and his dog and chimpanzees at the London Zoo and other kinds of data to arrive at this notion that we have these mammalian emotions. And Paul Ekman came along and really presented to science this way of doing that work, of coding facial muscle movements. And what happens when you do that science, and it really changes your life, and it changed my life, is you learn this coding system. It takes about 100 hours to learn how to code the face. And then it takes another couple of hundred hours of devoted work to really figure out how to use this system to differentiate fake smiles from real smiles, this muscle movement from that muscle movement, thousands of combinations. And I dove in as a young scientist, and I have coded more facial expressions than any human being alive. And it ruined my life in many ways. What happens is you get these little windows into human nature that I think Darwin had, who had a spectacular human eye, and writers have and painters have, and you train this system up in your mind, and you just start looking at human beings in a radically different way, right? And you start to see these patterns of our emotion that trace back in mammalian evolution. And I remember one particular moment when I was a postdoc living in San Francisco, and I saw this mom pushing her daughter on a swing, and I could tell that the daughter was struggling with a psychological condition, probably some deep form of anxiety, just by the tautness of her muscles. And I was going to play basketball, and I caught it out of the corner of my eye, and I looked at them literally for an instant, and just the way the mom was pushing her on the swing, you know, this young girl, and then her facial configuration, I knew that there was suffering in that family, right? Just by this Darwinian microscope onto the human face. And what that taught me is, and it really runs through, as you'll see, the science I'm about to describe to you, is that there are these little, it's a form of mindfulness, and we often direct mindfulness inside, but there's a social mindfulness of looking at other human beings that is fundamental to compassion and to community and the like. And that, once I saw that, I knew that I could figure out how our emotion of gratitude, which we think of as very, you know, higher order ethical concept, actually traces back, as I'll talk about, to patterns of touch that you see in chimpanzees, right? That our moral ethical emotions have these deep origins. So that changed my life and has led to a lot of science. The second thing that you know, I was lucky in that my parents came at the world from very unusual philosophical angles, right? I wasn't raised in a religious background or a very conventional background at all. It was a very unconventional upbringing. You know, my mom is to this day a little unusual in how she looks at the world, to my chagrin, and I have to constantly, you know, negotiate that. And my dad was really interested in Eastern philosophy. And, you know, as a young kid, I was hearing about, in particular, Taoism and Buddhism, and read Lao Tzu early in life, and just heard a lot about Buddhism. And that got me to question the standard Western model of human nature, which I'm about to describe to you, which, you know, in psychological science, my discipline, you know, it comes from Freud and economic theory and self-interest, and it is a philosophy of human nature that comes out of Victorian England and Enlightenment philosophy of Northern Europe, which is arguably the most individualistic, isolationist form of culture that has ever existed in human history, right? And out of that philosophy come ideas like evolutionary theory and selfish genes that were designed just to be selfish, right? Out of that philosophy comes ideas about hyper-individualism, that I am entirely separate from Nipun, right? And I'm just this separate bounded entity. And I was lucky because my dad and my mom in different ways, but my dad was kind of ushering me into Eastern thought, right? And I studied a lot of it as a young kid and college student, and to this day, of Taoism and the idea of the Tao and the unfolding mysterious way that you can't describe with language, right? That transcends kind of deliberative rational thought and all the great traditions of Buddhism. And I remember as part of my career, I got to be, there's a very interesting community. It's brought me into all these great connections, like with Nipun and others. And there's a small group of scientists who are interacting with Tibetan Buddhists, really largely pioneered by Richie Davidson, who's a dear friend of mine, and Paul Ekman, my former advisor. And so I got to be in a couple of conversations with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And I was early in this science up in Canada. And we were talking about the evolution of compassion. And he said, you know, just as a kind of a statement, he said, the human mind at its default setting is compassionate, right? And for a Western scientist, I mean, that literally was an epiphany. It just shook everything in me. And I'm like, well, what about self-interest? And what about selfish genes? And what about survival of the fittest? And what about, compassion is vulnerable or exposes you to weakness. And as I dug into that thinking, it just led me to kind of rethink who we are as a species. So that gets to the science. And I wanted to just talk about three highlights in this field that in part have come out of our lab. And I'm not sure how long you want me to go.
It's all good.
Okay. So what about compassion? If you go into evolutionary thinking, which is my intellectual tradition that really comes out of Charles Darwin, and you know, evolutionary biology and the sort of game theoretic approaches to pro-social behavior. Compassion, the idea that you would feel very compelling concern for other people's suffering, sacrifice, expose yourself to exploitation or vulnerability out of this sentiment, just as hard to make sense of from that perspective. And in fact, there were early debates in evolutionary science about why we are pro-social or kind to others. And the conclusions were, you know, well, maybe it's a supernatural thing. It's built into us. That's Alfred Russell Wallace. It's built into us by supernatural forces. And then there's the other perspective, which kind of prevails today, which is Thomas Huxley, who was an early advocate of Charles Darwin in Victorian England, that compassion is a social construct, right? That we're really selfish and base and greedy at our core. And compassion is this ethical principle that we invent as part of culture. And so what our lab has done is chart kind of the mammalian origins of compassion. And what we found is, we bring people to our lab in Berkeley, and other people are doing this work now. We'll show them images of suffering, right? So, for example, kids with cancer, or classic images of kids in a famine, where this is really tough stuff to look at. And what we find is really, I think, really kind of requires, as Nipun said, sort of how we revise our thinking about the human nervous system, which is, you know, we tend to think of the fight or flight branches of the nervous system, and that's the game. But in fact, when we show people these images of suffering, what we find is a very old part of the brain lights up, called the periaqueductal gray. It's not the frontal lobes where the empathy networks are, which is a where kind of the more recent developments of the human brain have been evolving. Rather, the periaqueductal gray is down near the brain stem. It's a very old part of the human brain and part of the mammalian nervous system. So what that tells us is in the human brain, when we feel compassion, it's activating old, ancient regions of our nervous system. The periaqueductal gray, when you stimulate it in other mammals, is triggers nurturant behavior and really non-specific nurturant behavior. If I trigger their periaqueductal gray in a sheep, it will take care of a cat. It just triggers this non-specific kindness, which is pretty cool. So now we have about 15 studies. If I see suffering, it activates my favorite part of the nervous system, which we've been obsessed with, which is the vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve is this bundle of nerves that starts at the top of your spinal cord. It wanders through your throat. It activates muscles in your throat and that allows you to look at people, make eye contact, which stimulates the release of oxytocin. And then it wanders down through your heart and your lungs and slows down your heart, right? So it allows you to orient to people and take care of them. And the vagus nerve continues to wander through your digestive organs and into your immune system. It's the largest bundle of nerves in the human nervous system, right? When you see the human nervous system mapped out, it's this big, long freeway of neurons that goes from your brain to your body. It's the mind-body nexus. And we now have about 12 replicated studies showing the vagus nerve supports compassion, right? When we feel compassion, when we act altruistically, if I vocalize in a compassionate way, the vagus nerve is activated. And so what that tells us is evolution began through different processes to craft this massive part of our nervous system that's about compassion, right? We've been designed to care. And then we can even push it back further in evolution, and this is where the literature on expression becomes really useful. I've been obsessed with the human voice, which is this amazing modality by which we communicate. We study these little thing called vocal bursts, which are brief little sounds that we communicate emotion with, right? So here's a sound I hear from my teenage daughter. See if you know what emotion this is. You know right away, right? I did this sound to a bunch of government officials from Hong Kong, and they knew right away, oh, she's dismissive of you, or disgusted, or, you know. Okay, I'm going to count to three, and I want you to give me your best compassion sound. One, two, three. Was that pretty? That was really pretty. And you guys even kind of harmonically went into song as you did that. I heard a little ooh. So indeed, when we capture these sounds, we get people to our lab and we say, what would you sound like if you saw a young baby who was really suffering? And people go, oh. So we capture that acoustically as well as other sounds. I have students that are going to all over the world, remote Namibia to study the Himba. We have a project in eastern Bhutan where there's very little contact with the West. And that allows us to look at, and in this particular village in eastern Bhutan, it takes days to get to, there's no electricity, no contact with the West. They hear these sounds. We ask them to tell us what emotion is being conveyed, and they know right away it's compassion. They haven't had any contact with any of our cultural forms, and they know that that's compassion. They know a lot of other emotions as well. So it tells us this is part of a universal language of compassion. But it's even more amazing than that. Primatologists who are studying primates out in the wild have noticed that primates have these little sounds that communicate emotion too. They have five or six categories of these sounds. And one of them, this absolutely astounds me, and this is the observation of Charles Snowden, which is a lot of the great apes, when babies die, the moms will carry the baby around for a long time. And when you see the photos of it, it is grieving, right? And it doesn't surprise us. holding it, nuzzling with it, keeping it on their body, skin-to-skin contact. What's stunning is as the mom is carrying around the baby who's dead, other great apes in the vicinity will vocalize sounds that sound just like our vocalization of compassion. They're called little coos, or they, right? And it probably has a very similar acoustic structure. So you can take our sounds, these very ancient, they predate language by a long shot, and trace them back in mammalian evolution to early forms of compassion in primates. Various people have been making the case that compassion is not an invention of human culture. It's a mammalian process. So when the Dalai Lama says this is a basic setting of the mind, it's rooted in neuroscience and this evolutionary discovery. Second stop is gratitude. And, you know, I approach these three emotions that I'll just talk about before the Q&A from, you know, there's been a lot of hostility towards emotions in Western thought, not so in Buddhism, where there are more sophisticated treatments of the varieties of compassion and equanimity and sympathetic joy than we've ever seen in the West. But there is a subset of philosophers who really felt that the emotions were the kind of the glue of social living. Charles Darwin believed that sympathy was our strongest instinct, right? And he came at that idea, it's quoted in The Descent of Man from 1871, he came at that idea through his own experience of suffering, watching his daughter Annie die of what looks like consumption. Emma, his wife, just couldn't handle the experience, and Darwin literally every day was with his daughter until she died. And out of that, he realized sympathy and suffering are the driving force of the human psyche and really foundational to our survival. Gratitude is another one of these moral sentiments in this philosophical tradition. Adam Smith, the economist, actually gets a bad rap in many ways. And he, at least in the critics of economic thinking, often associate with him with kind of pure self-interest. And he had a much more nuanced view of human social organization. And he called gratitude one of the most sacred, beneficent virtues. And there's this thinking in Western thought that dates back to Aristotle that we have these emotions, these passions that make us virtuous. And gratitude is one. When we feel the kind of how incredible the gifts are that are given to us. And it's such a great exercise to get people to start reflecting on gratitude, right? And just to take a moment. I recently did this at San Quentin Prison, where I go in a restorative justice program, and these guys were talking about the privilege to learn and breathe and be with friends. It is this glue of the appreciative social community. So I'll tell you just a brief gratitude story, which I think blows apart kind of Western conceptions of society and the individual within society. I have been really interested in tactile touch, as Nipun said. Primates build up cooperative communities through touch. They groom each other about 15 to 20% of their waking hours. Their grooming isn't random. It really is about building friendships. They trade food systematically with other primates that have groomed them earlier in the day. It is like if you were to make a map of a primate society, grooming would be the linkage between other primates. When primates, and this comes into my power book, want to keep power and keep the group together, they do a lot of grooming. You know, the alpha female and male will come up and like, okay, you're on my side, right? You know, and they groom away. Our science had totally ignored touch, and I don't know why. The Western Victorian culture was not too friendly to human touch for obvious reasons. But, you know, when you think about it, we have this incredible hand that is spectacular and dexterous and much more adroit than chimpanzee hands, which are very simplistic in terms of what it can do. And then our skin is an anatomical wonder. It is 6 to 8 pounds. It's the largest organ in the human body. It has billions of cells. It has tiny little cells that we're just starting to figure out that process information about who's touching you, what is the intention behind that touch. Your immune system has networks of cells in your skin. It's not a mystery why when you get a massage, you come out and you're like, I feel stronger than I felt in 20 years, right? That's because you just had your immune system massaged and it's firing on all cylinders, right? So in light of that, there's this amazing science that shows that if I give Nipun the right kind of pat to the back, reward circuits in his brain light up, his stress response of cortisol and a sympathetic autonomic nervous system response calms down. He feels confident. School kids who are patted on the back are more likely to try hard problems on the blackboard. And so we have gotten interested in, is touch this language of gratitude, right, by which we convey our appreciation to other people. The primate literature would suggest it definitely is, because that is their economy of alliances and trade, is grooming for food. If you give me food, I groom you and I say thank you. So here's what we did in our Berkeley lab to test this idea. We brought people to the lab in twos. There's a barrier in the lab. One person arrives and say, sit behind over there and stick your arm through a hole in this barrier. And they go, okay, you know, thank you. Another person arrives. We give them a list of emotions and we say, see that arm over there? Try to communicate these emotions by touching that arm, right? And they're like 10 emotions. Anger. No. And that person has to guess. That was angry, you know. Compassion. What would you do? Yeah. You know, and so they kind of grew, they sort of stroke and soothe the hand. They go, that was compassion. Gratitude. What would you do? That's interesting. Most people sort of do this like clasp and shake, right? And so the person guesses what emotion just happened. Chance guessing in this experiment was 8.33%. And they were able to detect compassion, love, and gratitude. Those are really intermingling concepts when you think about it, at about 60% accuracy, right? 7 times the rate of chance guessing. Just a little touch to the arm makes people, you can detect gratitude. Couple of gender differences. When women try to communicate anger to the male arm, he had no idea what she was doing. I know. And we replicated it. I was like, I don't believe that. We replicated it. Try another country. We got it in Spain, you know. And then regrettably, when the male tried to communicate compassion to the female arm, she had no idea what was going on. So not at Awakened Circle, where, and not when you're around Nipun, but that was that. So one of the things that we've been really interested in, and this is where the next frontier of this science is going, is to think about how these expressions of gratitude build strong communities. And a couple different written pieces recently, and in part it was inspired just by talking with you, Nipun, about the viral power of these positive behaviors, right? And there are several kinds of data that suggest that the more pro-social behaviors spread through social networks more rapidly and more virally. And so, you know, and it takes a certain kind of statistical sophistication and certain kinds of data, but we now can make the case for, if I express gratitude to Nipun in the moment with a tactile expression, we know Nipun will go on to other interactions and be more generous, then we know that those people whom Nipun has touched will go on to other interactions and be yet more generous, right? So my act of generosity here, now transcending individual face-to-face contact, is producing more generosity downstream, right? And you can just project that out. So these are very viral processes that build up cooperative networks. And there's a whole theoretical argument around that. So the final one that I'll leave you with and then open it up is awe. And, you know, in many ways, if, you know, when you read anthropology, there are origin stories in all human cultures, hunter-gatherer tribes on, and really the quest for life and what we're here to do begins in these big experiences of awe, you know, just where it may be out in nature. We're finding a lot of awe is in response to other people in around the world. We have data coming in from 25 countries where awe very often comes from being around generosity. Amazing. We had students go to the Himba who are in a way living in the conditions of our hunter-gatherer brethren and sisters who are, you know, small groups in Africa, very kind of basic existence with food and revolving around goats. And we asked them to tell stories about what made them feel awe. And I kept expecting like art and, you know, cosmology and, you know, all these. And they were like, the generosity of other people, right? Just blew their minds time and time again. So that's kind of a rudimentary form of awe. What we're finding is, and this work is, you know, Nipun was at this conference on awe, we'll host it at the Greater Good Science Center. And the science is, I would say, 25% done before we'll be able to have sort of a firm understanding of what this emotion is. But what we know is it really happens when you transcend the human scale, big or small, and when you're around things that challenge your current knowledge structures, right? You go, oh, I didn't imagine a tree could be so big, or a baby could be so funny, or this person could be so generous, or music could sound like that. We know Nipun has just, and we're building out practices around this, like walking out in woods, that just brief experiences of awe, as short as a minute or two, make you more generous, make you more humble, make you more empathetic, make you better at science. And we have findings showing that it actually calms down a branch of your immune system called the cytokine system. The cytokine response, you're hearing about it, is the inflammation response. It's just when cells attack pathogens in your body and you feel like you have the flu. It's good in the short term if you have toxins in your body, but if your cytokine system is always active, it is very bad news for human health. And awe quiets down that system, which is really incredible. And so we're taking this work now with veterans who have PTSD and inner city kids in Oakland and Richmond who don't get to get outside. And we're finding a day of rafting quiets cortisol and cytokine responses in these under-resourced communities. And we are starting to chart kind of this evolutionary history of awe, and goosebumps are this weird response where, you know, we have these little muscles around hair follicles that contract in the back of our neck, and they give you that sensation of goosebumps. But in mammals, a lot of mammalian species have the piloerection response. Primate, great apes do. They fluff up their fur. And we're starting to do a review of kind of the goosebump response in mammalian species. And you can go all the way back to rodents, like rats. Rats piloerect to connect to other rats when they're facing something that seems uncertain or dangerous, right? It's this early signaling of let's bond together into collective to be strong. And that probably will tell us a bit about the deep origins of awe and why we have this particular response to very collective processes. And so, you know, just to wrap up, these three emotions, compassion and gratitude and awe, I think they really, they in the simplest descriptive sense, they say the human nervous system isn't what, it isn't just fight or flight. Sigmund Freud gave us a great legacy. The two great instincts are sex and death. And we would say there's a little bit more than that, right? But then they also tell us that a lot of the great delights in life come from serving others, that the human mind is wired up, the human brain is wired up. You know, when you express compassion, you're getting this big rush of vagus nerve activation and oxytocin. This feels great. When you show gratitude to somebody or sharing, similar studies show you get activation and reward circuits in the brain. I'm finding inherent delight in serving others. And we'll find that with awe as well. We're about to engage in neuroscientific studies. So the whole model of self-interest in sort of separate individuals is, I think, will fall by the wayside. So that's what I wanted to say.
I feel like we could just keep listening to Decker. I mean, he's got so many things to share. As you raise your hand, we'll pass this mic around. But Decker, I want you to share that awe story that inspired you about awe. I mean, it's like it's a really cool story that gave him the goosebumps. I got goosebumps hearing that story secondhand. So, and I think this is true of Decker's journey. He experiences these things and then he looks to find it, find validation through science and support the whole world in it. So,
yeah. Well, you know, and it is, you know, William James and Charles Darwin, two of my inspirations. You know, so it's great about studying emotion. You look at your own experience, you try to figure it out, and we just use science. There are other kinds of traditions to do that. And, you know, we have all had awe experiences, and it's so fun to share them, and I'd love to hear some of yours. But, you know, as I was about to launch into this science of awe or wondering what the next thing to study was in the emotion world, mapping out this taxonomy of emotions, I was in Bhutan with my dear friend Leif Haas, and we were in a little village that revolved around these snow geese that migrate to Bhutan. They're big. The village has them. They name them. You go out and look at them, and they have individual identities, and the whole village revolves around them. And they have this great relationship to them, and they're these big, beautiful birds. And I think there are only 5,500 in the world. They migrate to Siberia. As we were about to head to this monastery, to visit this Buddhist monastery, people were telling us, well, you know, this monastery is special because when the birds migrate to Siberia, they fly up through this valley and they go 7 miles away to this monastery, and then they fly around the prayer pole 3 times and then go off to Siberia. And my friend and I are like, I love these legends. You know, isn't this remarkable what the human mind can say? So we drive up this road through this canyon, and there's this monastery, and we're at the monastery, and we're, you know, just, we were meditating a little, hearing the music and visiting. And that was incredible in its own right. And we start hearing these call of these birds, very loud calls. And the monks, man, they get all their best instruments. They get into their prayer hall. They're chanting deep, you know, and they got these beautiful instruments going. We're like, what's going on? You know, and they're like, the birds are coming. And so my friend and I are there, and the birds come in a beautiful pattern, and they fly around the prayer pole 3 times, and being the skeptical scientist, I documented each circumnavigation around the prayer pole. I was like, click, that's one, click two, click three, and then they go off to Siberia, right? And I was like, you're kidding me. You know? And it changed my life. You know, it really, and I think what we're starting to learn as well about awe is, you know, and this is E.O. Wilson's biophilia hypothesis that, you know, before industrialization, we had these deep understandings of nature and natural patterns, told us a lot about where to find food and how to be safe. And this was one of them that my Western mind took some scraping away to go, oh my God, that's real. So it was an incredible experience. And I have photos to prove it.
So we'll, if you have questions, raise your hand and I'll get the mic to you. We have a question back there and we have a question here. Why don't we go back first and then move the mic?
Thank you. I heard a radio program a couple months ago on...
Just to introduce your name.
I'm Bill. I heard a radio program on NPR a few months ago on the topic of mirror touch synesthesia that seemed pretty intriguing and seemed to explain some of my experiences. And I'm just wondering if you're familiar with the syndrome and if it's a real syndrome and what might be going on.
What do you elaborate?
It's this situation where people are so empathetic that they actually physically experience the sensation that they see in others. For example, one of the interviewees couldn't eat with other people because she always had a sense that food was being shoved in her mouth and she'd gag.
That's spectacular. And with touch as well.
Yeah.
Like you could feel somebody else's tactile contact would then be represented.
Well, I don't experience that, but I seem to feel other people's emotions so intensely that I kind of avoid people much of the time just to...
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so this, there are a variety of different demonstrations of this kind of mirroring of emotional response that, again, are part of this undermining of the assumption that we're all separate and different from others. Some of the famous studies were, you know, if I see... if I get burned on my skin, a part of your cortex, the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, lights up. That's the pain region, and it represents, wow, you're really feeling physical pain. If I see Nipun get a physical burn on his skin, that same region in my brain lights up, right? If I see Nipun be socially harmed, which is seemingly more remote than physical pain, that same region of my brain lights up. And so, you know, this kind of phenomenon is one of many different kinds of phenomena that are showing that my brain is just very simultaneously representing the many different experiences of other people. I didn't know about tactile contact, pain, delights, joy, thus initiating the response in myself. So the skin boundaries are quickly broken by perception and brain representation.
Your last comment prompted a question. Some people obviously don't act from compassion if you watch the news. So in your brain, Nipun being socially hurt would light up centers. Are there some people who have different responses light up, which is why they're not nice to people? Or
yeah, well, there, you know, evolution operates on individual variability. That's a kind of a canonical law in our field. But, you know, that really relates to my work on power in my new book, The Power Paradox. You know, with Paul Piff, who did the awe and tree study, a variety of different students. I've been really concerned about inequality and the new data. You know, we are the most unequal culture in the industrialized world. There's no comparison in a variety of different metrics in terms of income and criminal justice system. And we know now... that inequality harms the nervous system in young kids, hyperactivates the cytokine response, and actually restricts brain growth in the frontal lobes. So that kind of science, which I report on in The Power Paradox, led my lab to be interested in what are the processes that short-circuit compassion, right? And the what we find time and time again is money, materialism, and inequality, any combination of those social factors will basically turn off your compassionate response. I'm being a little dramatic, but we even have studies showing, you know, your vagus nerve won't fire if you think you're better than other people when you see a child who's starving, right? So I've been very interested in how inequality in particular, structural inequality in people above me, really undermines the pro-social stuff that we study. And inequality in money undermines gratitude. We have new data showing the wealthier I get, the less awe I experience, right? So it is a very compelling problem to be thinking about today.
And so these are things we can still develop, though, if we don't have as much compassion. Our behavior can help ourselves and others have more compassion and gratitude?
Very much so. And that's why, you know, if you go to the Greater Good Science Center, we have ggia.berkeley.edu, and there are now these science-tested practices that help you build up compassion, help you build up empathy, help you build up awe. You know, just loving kindness, which I know you probably do hear, things you guys are more aware of than I am, but you can, it's always flexible and malleable in terms of what you can build.
My name is Jonathan, and I don't think we have time to go into the story that I have about meeting a clinical psychologist who was my Uber driver. And so I said, why are you driving the Uber? He said, I'm a clinical psychologist at Yale doing research. So he started telling me about his research. And he is very excited about forgiveness as a positive emotion. And it's very, very powerful. I wonder if you could comment on that a little bit.
Yeah. You know, so it is, and when I teach human happiness at Berkeley, I do the usual evolutionary story. So remarkable, and this is Franz De Waal, who made this kind of paradigm-shifting discovery, which is he was studying rhesus macaques and chimpanzees, and when they get into fights, and these are animals, like a chimpanzee could tear any one of us to shreds. They're strong, they have big teeth, and when they get into fights, the conventional Western European wisdom was that they should separate and go as far away from each other as possible. And what Franz, who's Dutch, very egalitarian, observed is they do just the opposite, that chimpanzees and macaques who are fighting each other actually reconcile. And they will show gestures of succorance or weakness. They'll groom each other. They'll embrace. They'll present their rumps to each other and groom the rump. I wouldn't do that in human affairs. And what he said is, we have this instinct to reconcile and to forgive that has these mammalian roots. He's subsequently done this, and it's incredible. All mammals reconcile in the heat of conflict, except one species. No, humans do as well. Come on. The cat. The human the cat does not reconcile. So for all of you dog lovers, you're like, I knew that, you know. So, and I had a bunch of cats growing up, and they never reconciled. They like, shh, you know, and you'd be like, ah, and they'd walk away, you know. So what that tells us is we have this capacity in the heat of conflict and harm to show weakness, to embrace, and to forgive. And there are studies now in different labs that are exploring that in humans where, you know, just acting, engaging in a mental sort of contemplation of forgiving will slow the stress response down. And Fred Luskin at Stanford is doing really good work on forgiveness. It's a great question.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Nihal from India. I'm just on a visit, short visit here. My only question is that I'm seeing a lot of influence from West to East. Our lifestyles are changing. Our patterns of interactions are more like imitating the West. And I'm seeing like a lot of research for last at least 4, 5, 7 decades. You are talking about these. I heard mindfulness here in this Bay Area almost every day I'm here, which I'm hearing hardly like in few months time in India.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Even though I'm in India academic circles.
Yeah.
What is the impact this kind of research making in the society, or what would you recommend? What steps, you know, we can take all together, East or West, that we our social systems naturally promote this kind of compassion, gratitude, and all. Thank you.
That's a very deep observation. You know, we do know, you know, there are two patterns of too broad. It goes in both directions. And I think you're right to observe, and there are data showing, you know, for example, if you study social organization in China and India in the last 20 to 30 years with economic expansion, almost necessarily comes individualism. And individualism is great. It often introduces self-expression and freedom of rights and so forth, but it has a lot of costs. It breaks down community. And we've known that for 30 or 40 years, looking at the United States culture, which in some ways, Nipun is unusual. This is unusual. most Western European Americans don't get this experience. So there is this transmission of economic values that moves through cultures, and we can see how it breaks down communities. When I was in Beijing 5 years ago and I taught a bunch of leaders for a day, they were describing to me social ills that were catching them by surprise that I have been looking at for 20 years in the United States. Like, well, now I live in a different part of the country than my wife, and I don't get to see my kids, and we're overscheduled, and we have no time off. And I'm like, welcome to economic expansion individualism. But what we can do is I've been part of this science you've heard a little bit about, and just to, I'm not saying this gratuitously, it is an East to West influence, right? Kind of the foundations of this thinking of rethinking self and service and compassion really come from East, right? They come from Hindu scholars and Buddhist scholars and Western and Eastern scientists dwelling in those traditions and doing a new kind of science that has reshaped, it challenges Western conceptions of the human mind very deeply and convincingly. And it's interesting, just to give you a little interesting history behind this, Charles Darwin, who's a very unusual scientist in saying sympathy is our strongest instinct, was deeply influenced by David Hume, who was this great Enlightenment philosopher. There is now historical speculation that David Hume was hanging around some monks that had a lot of experience with Buddhism in his 18th century. So Hume probably got these ideas about kindness from Buddhism and transmitted them to Darwin, who then gave rise to this science. So I think what we have to do is we need, I'm optimistic. And so there's a good side to individualism, rights and self-expression. There's a very important side to communal life that we need to rebuild. And I think that's what I'm really committed to with this science, in terms of, I do a lot of work at Facebook and Google and Apple to kind of get them thinking about building real deep, strong ties.
Can you share a little bit about your work in the social network arena? Because I think that's fascinating. And I think I'm sure everyone is on a social network that you probably don't know you've been touched by Dacher's work.
Yeah, 4.5 years ago, I was going to invite Arturo here, who ran a big wing of Facebook called what is now called Protect and Care, which I'm glad they now have the word care there. They even have compassion teams, which is really exciting. They brought us in. We were some of the first lab scientists in, really not to do science. I'm not sure Facebook will ever yield data that's publishable, and that's too bad. But they've got 1.7 billion people connecting to each other, sharing information, and they're like, what do we do? So we were like, well, here's how you can use the science of kind language and kind speech to build out more compassionate exchanges. Here's how you can use the science of compassion to think about better breakups on the site, which was a neat set of tools that they built. Here is how you can use the science of kindness when somebody dies, to curate somebody's content on the site when they've passed away. There are several hundred thousand people a year who die and now have stuff on Facebook, and it's a complicated question about what you do with that. And then we helped redesign emojis and emoticons and reactions, and moving from that, which people were like, that's not emotional life. And now they've got a little, whoa. So... So we're working on it.
That's awesome.
And there's more in store. That'll be good.
Yeah. Here you.
Hi, my name is Michelle, and I've lived lots of places that you're talking about. I've been around the world, and I have a daughter who is half Chinese who is now entering the Wright Institute, getting a doctorate in clinical psychology. She'd be very interested in your work. My question is, how do you see this applying to how cultural groups react to other cultural groups? And, very interested in sort of the global, the human, the human entity and the well-being of the human entity. So what do you see about that and how this applies?
What a great question, Michelle. I mean, you know, people like me and Josh Green, kind of a moral psychologist at Harvard, regrettably, you know, and I often am accused of being Pollyannish about like the human nervous system. It's all good. And there's a lot of evolution also built into us problematic social tendencies like genocide, like rape. There's an evolutionary argument for that. And the us-them distinction. And what we've learned is the human brain responds to faces that are different than your own with a threat response, right? And that is just part of our evolutionary heritage. We're in small groups, other groups that were different from us. There now is pretty clear data that there were at least six kinds of distinct hominids moving around when Cro-Magnon were moving around in the context of our evolution. So we were kind of bumping up against things that were similar to us, but dangerous, and not of our own genes, if you will. And we respond problematically. And so the challenge is to use these tools to attack that full force, you know, and you see it in American politics today. That's why our science shows, you know, wow, a little burst of awe in nature, you're more open to different cultures. A little loving kindness practice once a day, which you can build into schools, your suspicions of different ethnicities drops. So it is something that we can't assume is easy to transcend, and we got to really move with force against.
Hello, I'm Philippe from Europe, France. And I had a question because my wife's a doctor in positive psychology. She was in undergrad with you, actually, she told me. And one day she told me something that I found very sad, and I need some help to solve that. She told me that people prefer sad news, sad stories, to happy stories and happy news. And that stayed with me badly. I hope you can solve that. Another question of mine is if you see like any big problem or challenge you would be happy to solve for the future, even if you have already done a lot. Yeah.
Well, so there is this is where science is really useful. There's this idea that the human mind likes or devotes more attention to bad stuff than good stuff. We like sad news more than good news. That was just an assertion with not a lot of data around it. And I think what we're learning about the human brain is it responds just as powerfully to good things and as to scary things. They're just separate systems in the brain that do that work. There are a lot of new data showing, for example, what's most viral through the transmission of news in social networks is what's awesome and kind, right? And so there are actually studies of what kind of New York Times stories get passed and clicked on, and it's more awe-inspiring that happened after this bad is stronger than good thesis. So I think the human mind does both, right? We are very invested in knowing what's dangerous and worrisome, and so our news cycles devote a lot of attention to that, but we have a lot of reason to be invested in what's inspiring and good, and we spread that through social networks as well. So it's both is the answer.
And on the challenge or problem ahead of you that you would love to be able to solve?
Well, you know, if you were to do the big equation of what is harming the random individual, the world citizen, climate change is the first, but inequality is right up there. and it's intertwined with climate change, very interestingly. And there is just this mounting science of, you know, we are more of an egalitarian species. Inequality imposes a lot of costs upon the human psyche. And so I think there are 10 or 12 things we can do that are inexpensive and non-ideological that can help us take on inequality. Otherwise, there are just a lot of new data showing that a lot of the social ills in the United States, from bullying to gum disease to marital distress, come out of inequality. And so that's an important thing to tackle.
I have a question. My name is Vijaya, and I had a question on when you said touch, would the prayer be the part of that touch?
Would what? I'm sorry?
Prayer.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so interesting. You know, in most cultures, acts of reverence and devotion involve some sort of self-touch, but they also involve postures that go down, right? And ironically enough, that kind of movement actually activates the vagus nerve. So, you know, people are starting to think about, you know, the kind of the mind-body interface in these acts of reverence. They're not random. Right. If you go to different parts of the world, we show our reverence in very similar ways in our vocalization patterns and in what we do with our bodies. And there's probably some mind-body interface in that that has yet to be documented. And so, and touch and certain postures are very important to that process. It's a great question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dakner. My name is Parth. The question I have is, you know, it's kind of a twofold question. One is, in your research, have you seen that the impact of social media like Facebook or Twitter or everything that exists out there has actually made people more individualistic than what they were? Because we are very active on the internet, but what I see is that people solve everything on the internet through messages that they hardly interact with each other in a physical forum like this.
Yeah.
And the second question is, does more individualism, you know, which I personally am against, but you know, that's a separate topic of discussion. You know, does more individualism lead to even lesser development of compassion and awe and those emotions which are very important to maintain a very saner society that we don't have today, you know? Thank you.
Yeah, so I'll start with your second question first, which is an odd rhetorical strategy, but so I think that's a fair way to summarize it. And what we find is individualism, thinking about money, materialism, and then inequality tend to short-circuit these compassion, gratitude, and awe. They diminish them in a variety of different kinds of studies. So regrettably, you know, and people have been worried about this for a long time. People like Robert Putnam, who wrote this famous book, Bowling Alone, are showing that with individualism, you lose the emotions that tie us to one another. And I think that is why I am worried about individualism like you. But, and then, you know, the effects of the new social media on our communal identities and our compassion are as yet we don't know. We do know pretty with rigorous data that Facebook connections matter. They aren't superficial, and they aren't a different kind of relationship. They're just a weaker kind of relationship. We also know that for about 75% of people, if you really intentionally do stuff on Facebook, it will give you boosts much like a friendship would. Right? And that often counters a lot of stereotypes out in the broader society. And I think that then poses the challenge for Facebook, which is how do you kind of create an experience where you're sharing more vulnerable stuff, you're sort of engaging expressions of gratitude that are more powerful. So it's a softer version of a face-to-face social network that will never replace it. And there's a lot of work to do. So part of it is we don't know.
Hi, my name is Sairam. I was wondering, have you explored intuition and gut feeling in your research?
Yeah, that's a great question about gut feeling and intuition. So one of the really important developments that came out of this science of emotion that I'm part of is, for a long time, we've thought that a lot of the most important decisions we make are these rational, deliberative decisions, right? And you're already like, that can't be true. But, you know, but scientists honestly believe that, you know, when we decide on punishing somebody or we decide on an economic policy or what candidate to vote for, we tally up all the costs and benefits and calculate probabilities and make our decisions. And that's just not how people move through the world. And there's this whole new movement of Josh Green and John Haidt, who is a friend of mine, in moral psychology, showing that our gut, and Danny Kahneman, his Thinking Fast and Slow, our gut is equipped through evolution with these deep reactions that guide our decision making, right? So when you get into a state of compassion, we have a whole line of studies showing it makes you see more similarities between people. It makes you more forgiving, as one of you said. You're less likely to be interested in retributive punishment. So these feelings, Jean-Paul Sartre has this great quote where he talks about how the gut feelings produce these magical transformations by which you look at the world. And so when you're in the compassionate mindset, it guides all kinds of decisions in very systematic ways. And that's true of other emotions as well. So we have begun to think about feeling and intuition. It's a big literature.
My name is Hemi, and I was your observation with the primates that you said that even when they're angry, they manage to find a way to reconcile very quickly. Reminded me of Viktor Frankl in his book, where he said that no matter what happens to you, there is a split second where you can react to something. I was wondering if you have any studies or any techniques, like you said, there's techniques on compassion. Are there any techniques to reconcile quickly?
Well, you know, and this is where you really push the limits of human compassion, right? So when I teach forgiveness to older audiences, I'll most typically have somebody who's lost relatives in the Holocaust. And so, you know, do you promote compassion and forgiveness in those contexts? And you get into these really complicated extremes of forgiveness techniques, right, about how you work through that kind of harm. But what we've learned in this, you know, both comes through Fred Luskin's work, and there are these kind of practical steps to forgiveness about, you know, really grasping why the person harmed you. Think through the forms of suffering that led to that harmful act, to kind of take a moment and recognize you're not going to have this clean view of them where they're restored to their original condition, but it's a more complicated view, and that's part of the story. And then there are kind of social practices that you can engage in that, you know, that people put to practice in Rwanda and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, where it's about really, and this is in restorative justice, which I work on in prisons, which is, you know, really expressing your grievances, listening and hearing with deep respect, right, if you've been harmed, putting victim and perpetrator together. So there are these techniques that are starting to spread that are yielding pretty good results. So.
Hello, I'm Richard. I'm not sure if this relates exactly, but I know some people who are very concerned about, I guess, what could be called a retreat from face-to-face interaction into the digital world.
Yeah.
And that their concern is that maybe the emotional skills aren't developing, and the less people are able to function socially, the more they're going to retreat, and that when adolescence happens and all the hormones kick in, things go wrong pretty badly. I just wonder if you've had any thoughts or know any research or anything around this area?
A lot of people are really worried about it, and we don't have the empirical data yet, and I alluded to some, which is the key for kids is to use the new platforms intentionally and actively as opposed to passively, right? So if you go in and you think about, this is a way I'm going to share some information that really matters to me via Facebook, that'll be a very meaningful experience where you're transmitting political news or social news or the like. And there are going to be contexts in certain individuals who really not benefit from that kind of experience. The thing that, how I always think about this is, this could take up a whole evening, but Facebook means many different things in many different countries, right? And in many parts of the world, it's the news, and it's how people understand what's happening in the world. In other parts of the world, it is how women bond together to fight against patriarchal violence, and that is well documented. In the United States, it is I think, on its best moments, a countervailing force to loneliness. 20 years ago, there was an epidemic of loneliness, right? Literally, this was one of the central concerns in the social sciences is we were spending, the average American teenager was spending 4 to 6 hours a day by themselves watching TV, right? Gilligan's Island and the like or whatever. So Facebook has come in and kind of replaced that with a different experience. And, we'll see where we land in terms of its benefits. I'm a little bit more optimistic than most people that I think once it's designed right, it will connect us in a remote way, which is part of our human connection, but never replace face-to-face. And we'll see. I may be dead wrong.
Hi, I'm Bruce. What do you see as the relationship between these basic fundamental emotions that trace back to our history or heritage all the way back, and how those might come together in the narratives and stories that we construct around our lives that give us who we are.
Yeah.
It seems to me that those are related.
Yes. Yeah. I have to go I'm giving a commencement speech at a high school tomorrow, and that's exactly what I'm going to say, which is... No, I think that, I have a co-author of a textbook on emotion, Keith Oatley, who's also a novelist, prize-winning novelist and a cognitive scientist. And that's his thesis, which is that, and I think that's the best way to think about these passions that we've been talking about, from beauty to awe to compassion to gratitude to fear to anger, probably 15 or 20 of them, right, is that they're really stories. And anthropologists wrote a lot about this, that emotions are little dramas that you have. Well, we are all genetically shaped to veer towards certain emotions. Some of you may really feel that awe is a defining emotion, others compassion, others gratitude or the like. And what those experiences of those emotions do is they build up these big narratives of life, right? They tell us that, for me, compassion being something my mom gave me, I have to be near human suffering and working on that to feel like I'm alive. I just have to get into a prison and talk to people who are in solitary confinement or what have you. And that just is the narrative to my life. For others of you, it may be sensory beauty, right? And all of your life will be organized around that passion. And that makes sense neuroscientifically, which is knowledge is stored within emotional structures. Your emotions guide what you look at in the world, right? If you're an awe-prone person, you'll just see awe everywhere, right? You'll be like, that chandelier and the patterns of light, and look at the shadows, right? And the beauty person's like, I don't get that. Can you hand me some more food or whatever? So, and we don't have the great data on that, but I think that's where the field is going, is that these are the stories of life. And Keith Oatley and other people have made this point that if you analyze the stories that are told around the world, they tend to be around certain emotions. There are the tragedies and the comedies and the inspiring stories and the stories about injustice, right, that at their core are driven by emotion. So I think you're right.
My name is Ron, and I'm wondering if there's any empirical research on the potential impact of a national leader on the psyche of the citizens in terms of... you know where I'm going with this. In terms of compassion and generosity and awe.
Yeah. Well, it's you know, it's funny how upset we all are in this very stirred up time, you know. And I think that, you know, frankly, with certain social conditions, economic, we've seen this little emergence in Western cultures of fascism, right? And fascism does have an emotional core to it that's been, you know, of the disgust of people who are different from you, fear-mongering and a bullying type style. And there are political scientists that they haven't gone as far as what you've talked about, which I think is really, really important. But they talk about a national mood that we do, for very obvious reasons, fluctuate in our feelings as a culture. And I would worry about what happens if that particular leader were to win and what it would do to the psyche. And it'd be an interesting thing to study.
Questions, but I think we'll... Okay, Jose is saying there's one over there. She's had her hand up longest, so we'll go there, and we'll go there. And then I want to end with putting Molly on the spot, Dacher's wife, and be like, what's it like to be with the guy who says, honey, no, that's the wrong facial expression. I'm actually being compassionate. You just can't touch sense me. That's what the data says. So we'll just go end over there if that's okay. So we get two more questions, one here, and then we'll end there. Speak into the mic.
So 2 years ago, I did one of the 10-day meditation retreats, and it was such a powerful experience to be in that meditation hall with dozens of other people going through this other, you know, powerful experience, and it was, you know, awe-inspiring. And then I started college, and I was, you know, in my dorm room trying to find 10 minutes between classes, trying to, you know, squeeze in 10 minutes of meditation, and it was a very different experience. So do you think there's a possibility of not even needing skin-to-skin contact, but something like vibrations in the air, like of being with other people that can have that kind of awe-inducing effect?
Wow.
She's a Berkeley student.
You know, you would just think about what we do know is that as I sit with you and you have your wonderful postures and smiles and beautiful looks in your face, that is just being absorbed by my nervous system and through the sensory information. So you don't need skin-to-skin contact for a lot of good. You're proposing a more radical idea that right now is beyond what we know how to measure, although you could probably do, you know, certain kinds of, you know, capturing of magnetic rays or whatever it is, where someone would be there, there'd be Nipun over here, I wouldn't see him, I wouldn't sense him, and somehow the vibratory patterns would be coming through Nipun to me and activating my vagus nerve. You will be a famous scientist if you make that discovery. Is it possible? I think so. I mean, I'm open to it. You know, there. At our day of awe, we learned that about 90% of the universe is invisible and dark energy. So there are all kinds of processes that we don't measure or capture. So,
hi, Dacher. Great listening to you. I'm climbing these stairs. It's like around 12 stories. Okay, and... I've done it before, but the 12 stories is like my first time. And after I'm done with it, I'm sitting at my desk, and my heart is like just pounding. And I am like literally experiencing that, and I'm in so much awe of that, just loving that. I could feel my heart. So my question is, sometimes I feel that, you know, the self-interest is somewhat misdirected. We somewhat associate it to greed, materialism, isolation and stuff. So, but what if it is directed towards or focused instead on, you know, just the awe of this body, you know, just the awe of this technology that we have here in ourselves?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really, so if I understand your question correctly, you know, the one of the things that I think this conversation brings into focus is where do we find delight and meaning in life, right? And what's interesting about the human brain is we have a reward circuit that delights and lights up and gives us pleasure for a lot of self-interested things, food and nice touch and, you know, intimate contact and friendship and music and the like. But, you know, this new science that we've been talking about tonight shows that we also are activating these self-interested networks in the brain by serving others, by sharing resources, by cooperating, by forgiving, by expressing gratitude, right, by feeling compassion. And I think that the healthy mind is a nice balance of those forces. And your sort of misdirection observation is really a statement about what we're worried about individualism, which a lot of you have talked about today, that we take this very rich brain that can take delight in so many different things, and we zero it in on the Pottery Barn sofa, right? And we're like, that is the key to my life. And that is inevitably going to fail. So we've got to broaden it back out, like you're suggesting, to direct it at the right causes.
Before we have Decker close, Ollie, any thoughts, any reflections? You've grown up with this, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I knew Decker when he was 20 before he ever studied any of this, so I think maybe I would have been more intimidated by it. But I think just if you're honest, you don't have anything to hide, and you know, don't have to worry about what your face is doing. That's my advice to you.
How has he changed a lot since 20? Or has his research changed?
Oh yeah, his research is always changing. Every 5 years, he's studying something really different.
No. Has his research changed him as an individual? Oh. Like, is he totally different now than, like, after studying awe? Like, is he more awe prone?
Yeah, I think he gets really excited by everything he studies. So every 5 years, he kind of gets, you know, interested in something new, and that affects whether we buy a Pottery Barn couch or not.
That's great. Thank you for being here. Any closing thoughts, Decker?
So I'll leave with a variation of a quote that my mom gave me of Percy Shelley, who's the great poet. And this is a quote from In Defense of Poetry, and I think it captures this really interesting, remarkable capacity of our human mind. The great secret of morals is love, and a going out of our own nature, and an identification of the beautiful that exists in thought, action, or person not our own. So what Shelley is saying is the human mind has this really incredible, unprecedented capacity to find beauty and delight in other people. And I think that really is the core to tonight, to Nipun, my dear friend, and to being with you. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.